Welcome back, everyone, to MX Asian American. Today we have Jane. You want to introduce yourself first to the audience?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Karen. Oh gosh, how to introduce myself? I think first and foremost, I'm a restaurant baby. Grew up in a takeout restaurant. I am a poet, a memoirist, and a hopeful ceramicist. I really like to eat. I mean, I think that's a core part of just my being, is I was just telling you before we started to record that I just ate way too many high chew and I'm feeling kind of ill. So you can always gauge my, personality just based on what I ate. So
This will be an ill podcast. Thank you, Jane, for coming on the show. I have been an admirer of Jane's work for a while. Today we're mostly going to talk about Jane's new memoir, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City. But of course, Jane has two poetry books, Overpour and How to Not Be Afraid of Everything. But I always like to ask my guests to tell us a little bit about how and where they grew up, just way back when. I know you said you're a restaurant baby. I am too, but give us a little bit more like background on
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad to meet another restaurant baby. Oh my gosh, may we throw like rice grains at each other.
that.
So I grew up on the Jersey Shore. So I do miss Jersey quite a bit. I'm in Seattle right now. And I've been in Seattle for a chunk of time. But yeah, I grew up in New Jersey, in a little takeout restaurant, and it was a little strip mall, and it was right next to Tony's pizzeria, and I can see the strip mall in my mind. It was like a Sally Hansen. It was a Burlington Coat Factory, and there was Wow Workout World, and so that's kind of how I grew up. I am definitely the first in my family to go to college and finish traditional high school too. So, as a college professor, I feel very like deeply attached to, I guess, kind of my working class roots and like being the first to graduate college. It's been a journey, I think. And I will say too, like becoming a writer, what a risk, I think, as someone who is the first, and there's that sense of responsibility. And I was like, I'm gonna be a poet. So that was something else. But yeah, that's kind of how I grew up. I'm definitely a Jersey girl at heart.
Yeah, a lot of similarities we have. I'm also a restaurant baby, also the first to go to college in the family, also eldest daughter, also a poet.
Yes.
Did you ever realize when you wanted to become a writer, and what led you to actually like go through with that decision?
Yeah, that's I love that we have all this in common, and also I'm like so feeling so kismet now. I'm just like, oh my gosh, all the things there's I feel like there's going to be like things like those cans or those like cups that you have as telephone, like I don't know what they called it back then, but I was just like, I feel like I'm doing
I know
that
what you're talking
via Zoom though,
about.
or whatever. I really fell in love with writing because of the public library. I mean, ultimately that was it, because it was right across from the strip mall, and this was back in the 80s when you could just leave your children places, I suppose. And so my mom would just leave me there at the public library, and I would just read and read, and I fell in love with reading in these like worlds and these characters. And I was also a deeply angry and bratty child too, and I always felt in some way I was like, I can do this, and maybe I could even do this better than some of the authors. And it's mostly because I didn't see myself reflected in the stories I was reading, right? Like, it just, I didn't see any characters that looked like me or shared similar stories to me. And so I always felt like I wanted to create that space, not just for myself, but I think for my classmates too. I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood, and so it was a little odd that we're just reading, all these stories about, like white kids, basically. So I knew from an early age that I wanted to write, but yeah, it was definitely something that I fought for many years because I just didn't think it was going to be a possibility. Truly, it's like when you look at the bookshelves and you don't see, writers who look like you, it can be really difficult, I think, to envision the future in which what you really want to do can come true. But yet, here I am. So I am very grateful for my literary lineage, though. I feel like, as someone who also teaches Asian American literature, I feel like, going way back to Angel Island poetry and seeing the kind of route I think Asian American, writing has taken, it's quite incredible, honestly. And it's flourishing and it's exciting right now. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was as I was listening to you talk about how you didn't see any of the same characters reflected to you when you were growing up. I was just thinking about how like now I go to the library. I still go to the library because I don't have money to buy books. But it's like amazing that there's so many now like Asian American writers like on the shelves that I don't know like. This generation younger than me is so lucky.
Yes. And there's so many amazing kids books too. It's like right behind me, the oh, I don't know. It's like the Asian American A to
Oh,
Z.
yes, I know that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my friends Kathy and Kyle wrote that. And so there's just so many wonderful books for young people too out. So I
Yeah.
know it's so such an amazing time. And then I feel really grateful that I'm able to teach Asian American lit, like especially now. I think that there's honestly, it's really difficult to make the syllabus. It's actually at a point where I'm like, I don't even know,
Yeah.
what to include because I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much
There's so many.
available now and out there, and especially having guests come into class, and it's really exciting. The only thing is that, as these books are, really kind of flourishing, the curriculum is not. So the fact that there's only one Asian American lit class makes
Oh my
me
gosh,
furious.
we could talk so much about this. But yeah, I'm just curious how your parents reacted when you were like, I'm gonna be a writer.
It's so kind of interesting, I think, coming from like a low-income working class background to a certain degree, that my family was really kind of like they were just kind of like confused, like they couldn't even understand like what does that mean? Like they weren't mad. I never actually felt pressure, honestly, from family in terms of, becoming a lawyer or a doctor or anything of that sort. I think it was like they were just so baffled with me and me just generally. I was a strange child that they were like, okay, well, but I think that, ultimately my family was just very obsessed with this idea that as long as I could provide for myself and, that I felt like comfortable. My mom is a really unique person. And she, I think because she's such a creative person, she was like, oh, of course she's going to become a poet. Like that's just, I just, it's almost like it's like, can Chinese hippies exist? Like my mom is kind of a hippie, but without knowing what that means, like she just is very,
Wangmom.com.
yes, exactly. And like she's incredibly open to possibility. And so I would not be a poet, I would not be a writer if it wasn't for my mom because she really pushed me towards it. And she, since the beginning of my life, even she told me when I was born, I would just stare at her and basically was like, oh, she knows too much. There's too like why does this baby know something I don't know? And so, the memoir talks a lot about this kind of like ancestral knowledge. And I think that whatever it is that, you know, her poet self kind of got passed down to me of sorts. So even though, you know, she wasn't able to necessarily, you know, publish her poems or like write them down, just due to kind of educational barriers to a certain degree, I feel like she's the ultimate poet. And, you know, my father's not in my life. And I think that I do in some way hope that he's proud of me. I don't, you know, think that he knows that I've made a life of this, but, you know, I do feel kind of cheesily proud. Like I wanted to do something since I was very little, and I kind of just, I went for it, like fully. And I feel there was a lot of challenges along the way, but I did, I never wavered in my like in envisioning of this kind of creative life. Yeah.
As you should be proud for it.
I'm and crying another, like I'm crying like, you know, like Asian tears, like I'm helping
Asian tears. But another similarity is like my parents also never pressured me to do anything. Mostly they're worried about me providing for myself, right? And also when I told them that I was studying English, they're like, you already know English. Yeah, so they don't really know what I do either. They're just like, you write a lot of things. I don't know.
Love it. Yep, that's the same thing. It's just like, And just even like saying when I'm working, and unfortunately sometimes I'm like working at like 11:30 p.m. like grading or whatever it is, and my aunt's like, "What? Why is school open?" And I'm like, "No." School's not open, but yeah, so there's just confusion as to kind of like what it also means to be a professor. I think also it's just it's been, I don't think they ever fathomed that I would be doing this, so yeah, I am grateful for their support though. I do feel supported though they may be confused, like, you know, I'll never forget when I got a Fulbright to live in Hong Kong after I graduated from college. Everyone in my family was like, don't go. Why would you go to China? Like, no, that's not like, don't go to Hong Kong. We like tried to like, you know, come here. And I was like, what? It was like the first reaction should have been congrats, I guess, for most families, because it's, you know, a nice fellowship. So anyway.
Yeah. So you got your MFA from the University of Iowa, which very prestigious, and lots of thoughts on that.
Yes.
Could you share your experience at Iowa as a Asian American female?
Ooh. I think that what I will say about my time at Iowa was that, you know, I kind of learned later in life kind of how to be an educator, how to be a supporter, and this, you know, someone who celebrates their students' work. I learned my pedagogy by like what not to do, I think, at Iowa. The Iowa method is toxic, and it centers whiteness. Just to say it bluntly, I mean, the silent rule, all of it, the idea of critique. I don't. You know, I don't even know if I like the term workshop, honestly. I don't usually use it in my classrooms. Like, I think my, you know, my students would definitely say that, you know, I create a community and a vibe. It's more of just this kind of connection, I think, that we all are entering this space together. And I, you know, in sharing our work with the vision of creating whatever, you know, the kind of most tenderhearted slash like craft driven like version of the thing that they're trying to make. Like, there is never, we don't talk about things working or not working, you know, in a piece, because I'm not interested in my poems doing labor for me. And so, you know, I in many ways was really difficult. It was very isolating, quite literally in Iowa City, but also, you know, obviously, I think for a lot of the, you know, BIPOC writers, we felt definitely isolated, and sometimes even like the expectations of what you will write were kind of like uncomfortable. I think also, you know, there was a deep competitive spirit at Iowa. And I'm not that person, I think, that thrives in spaces of rigor in that way. I believe in kind of community. And it was until I left Iowa that I went to Kundiman. Like, I needed to go to Kundiman, which is an Asian American literary organization, to kind of honestly start the process of healing, I think, from a lot of the trauma that happened at Iowa, you know, including professors saying that, you know, my poems were like going to IKEA full of cheap furniture you can't put together. And so, like, what do you do when you get a comment like that as a student? And so it was hard. It was really hard. I think that, you know, I found the wonderful people I found. I found my readers. I found my dearest friends at Iowa. And those people, you know, over making dinner, watching Top Chef, like we made a life for ourselves, you know, in the space that wasn't kind to us. Like, we created that space. So I will say, I took a lot of, you know, there was so many beautiful things, I think, leaving Iowa too. But, you know, I still visit sometimes. I guess I went back for my last book and my first book too, and it's so wonderful to be at Prairie Lights. And, you know, but I will say that I really want to kind of like recreate my MFA experience through, I guess, my own teaching, I guess, and kind of trying to foster a much more caring space, I think, for my undergraduates, but also my MFAers as well. So it's hard to put in a nutshell, but I was like, Iowa, oh, yep. Iowa
You
there.
do write about it. You write about it, it, but mostly your experience at Kundiman. But yeah, you started as a fiction writer and then you moved to poetry and then now again to nonfiction. How is it like going between genres?
Yeah, you know, genre is so funny to me because it's so slippery. I think that ultimately, you know, for me, it's always down to kind of core world building or like description. I'm obsessed with imagery. I've always been obsessed with imagery, and I think like I feel like it saturates me, you know, when I'm writing. A lot in terms of synesthesia and like the taste, the smell, the touch, the goop, but like I want to see and touch and feel and like slurp things. Like, that's always been, maybe that's also part of growing up in a
Your
restaurant, was
imagery
like,
plant.
yeah, exactly. And so you know, yeah, growing up in a restaurant, it's like you're surrounded by so much intensity at all times, sensory intensity. And so I feel like that just, like, you know, exists in my writing. That's my favorite thing to do in writing. And so that's across all genre. I've always wanted to try to kind of like stay with a thing. If I can watch like a orange rot for a very long time, I would be like,
Oh my
oh,
God,
that's
I love that
a happy place.
poem.
Oh, thank you. It was like, you know, it was super fun to write and to see the oranges like rot, both like when I on YouTube, but I actually, you know, I did it myself also in my compost bin. And so I think that, you know, I also do interdisciplinary art. Like, I've had a kind of, I guess, poetry sculpture installation show at the Frye Art Museum and a few other places. And I do ceramics and I make paper as well. And so I feel like regardless of the medium, I feel like very inspired by storytelling. At the end of the day, it's storytelling. And I think images are a story. Like, I think when you even just have one metaphor, one image, it is a story. And so I've been obsessed with, I think, like, across genre, how do you create constellations of storytelling? Like, how do we connect the narrative together, I think, with the reader? So I guess all to say, I'll probably come back to fiction. Now that I've moved into back to prose, I love writing in scene, it turns out. I had forgotten how much I love writing in scene and dialogue. And yes, these characters are real people. You know, like, my mom is my mom. But it's also really fun to kind of like, I don't know, like stay longer with each quote unquote character person in my memoir and kind of develop them as they are real human beings, and they are indeed. I love it. I love the kind of, again, mixture of genre and discipline and medium.
I have never been able to write prose, so I think it's amazing when somebody else like is doing all of this multi-genre, interdisciplinary, etc., all this stuff.
I am pretty positive you can write prose.
Okay, thanks. So in your newest book, the memoir Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, you basically credit and reference a lot of writers who've influenced your work, and I feel like in a lot of ways this memoir is trying to break the canon. And you did allude to this also when you were talking about Iowa, but was there a time that you ever wanted to write for the white gaze? And how did you eventually like turn away from that?
That's a great question. I love just getting right into it. I mean, I think that whether or not, you know, I wanted to write towards the white gaze is almost
irrelevant.
Irrelevant. What was I going to say? Reverence, which is like a totally different word, but irrelevant, because the white gaze will follow you wherever you go. Like, it's not, you know, it's going to be there. And I knew it was going to be there from the beginning. And it always has and still is there, you know. And I think a lot about, you know, and I write again, like you said, I write about kind of a lot of internalized racism, kind of growing up and desiring whiteness and desiring, you know, to be those writers who are on the shelves at the public library that didn't look like me, and wanting their lives, like, you know. And, you know, there's this scene, I think it's in Root Canal Street, the chapter, Root Canal Street, where I desire the white teeth of these white girls in school so much that I want to like knock them out of their mouths and like put their white teeth into my mouth. Like, I just, it's like this, that desire to have something that I can't have, both in terms of that whiteness, but also its proximity to I guess like a higher social class. And so I think that, you know, I'm very aware of the white reader in many ways. In the memoir, I was kind of almost like feeling this like constant like ick feeling of like, oh, they're just going to treat this memoir as like poverty porn or intergenerational trauma porn, or just kind of like they're just going to like lap it up. Oh, she grew up poor in the strip mall and now she's a professor, the American dream. Like, I just was so afraid of that, you know. And you've read the book, it like pretty much halfway through, though it's hinted at throughout the book, you know, in The Object of Love, I kind of say it pretty much bluntly, like, this is not what you're think, this book is not going to be what you think it is. You know, I think I'm paraphrasing myself, but I say kind of like, you know, they want intergenerational trauma dessert, and they lap at blood before blood can even exist. I'm paraphrasing myself, but I say pretty bluntly to the white reader to kind of be like, hey, like, if you thought this, it's not going to be this. And I appreciate you saying kind of like that the book attempts to kind of break, I guess, maybe like tropes or this idea of what memoir is supposed to even be, because I was very, very conscious of that. Like, I really wanted to write a book that was going to break quite a few rules, or at least break expectations, I guess. Like, memoir itself is supposed to be in the past or in memory. And this book goes into a present and it goes into a potential future, which is, you know, wongmom.com. And, you know, I make up a character, which is kind of breaking a nonfiction rule, and a few other things like that happen in it that is not a singular story of growing up in a restaurant, which is kind of how the book was, you know, originally, you know, my agent at the time kind of really had this idea of it being this particular story and it and not necessarily having all of the multitudes it currently has. So yeah, it is, the book is a lot. It's hard to actually boil down into a couple sentences as a description.
That's true.
But I think that's just also who we are. I wanted the book to feel like me and feel like my family's experiences. And so it's also nonlinear because migration is not linear. And I just really wanted, maybe that's where the poetry background comes in. I really wanted form to really mirror the emotional weight, the content that was happening in it. That's a long answer, but it's a great question. I mean, you know, I wasn't writing this book for the white gaze. I knew it was always going to be there. It always is and always will be, unfortunately. But there's also this sense of, like, you know, being very purposeful, I think, in my writing and language to declare that this book is actually for kind of like my younger self. Like, this is for me and for my Asian American community and immigrant communities, people who grow up working poor. Like, it's, yeah. Yep.
Wow, I really want to be in your class.
I don't know,
just like hearing you talk and like well, when you talked about how your book broke a lot of like conventions of writing a memoir and like with the imaginary future, I am reminded of this book on theory. It's Candace Chu, Imagine Otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just made that connection. And then also, you talked about the teeth. I was going to ask about the teeth. The teeth sections. I love the teeth sections because I'm insecure about my teeth. Because I had never grown up having insurance to go to the dentist, right? And a lot of us don't. So yeah. For the first time, I went to the dentist last year when I was 22. I felt a lot of shame around that. Yeah. But also, like, I went... The doctor was like, "Is your first time?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's my first time." And he was like judging me hard. And I had to pay for that visit too. It was expensive. But yeah, and talking about being adjacent to whiteness, and all of that. And like this morning I was reading Sarah Ahmed, How to Living a Feminist Life, about how like white supremacy upholds whiteness as happiness, basically. And maybe like wanting to be white is also like wanting to reach that happiness. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Lots of thoughts.
I think that also you sharing about the shame, like about dental care, especially, hits really like real and hard for me. I think that for that chapter, Root Canal Street, which was originally a standalone essay, I had to get my mom's permission, you know, I mean, for the whole book, I had to get everyone's permission, but like, you know, to get, that was the only chapter that she had trouble with in terms of whether or not she wanted people to know she had real teeth or not. That was really hard. Mm-hmm. That was hard for her because she's a very, you know, a very proud woman, but I was like, she's kind of vain in the best way. Do you know what I mean? Like she knows she's beautiful and she's very put together, and having to say, you know, having to tell people through the essay that she doesn't have any real teeth and that we didn't grow up with insurance and all of the things that she tried so hard, I think, as a single mom too, to kind of like appear like we had all the things, but when we didn't, you know, or like, you know, couldn't pay our bills, like, it's just I can see her having so much pride in all of this. And so having her finally agree, I think, to me writing the essay was ultimately, it's an essay or a chapter about our relationship and this kind of sense of like making sure that we're taking care of each other in sometimes the most potentially dangerous situations, including going to illegal dentists. So like she agreed, but it was hard for her because, like, you know, there's a lot of shame. And I still, even though I have health insurance, I, you know, as a professor, I do not know the last time I went to a dentist. It might have been in the book, I think. Oh, wait, yes. Okay, so there's one moment in the book where I go to the dentist in Seattle, and I think that I want to say that it's like 20, I don't remember when, it's like the early teens of the, whatever, the 2000s. And then I had to have my wisdom tooth pulled out because it was rotting in Bellingham. So that was the last time I went, but I only go kind of during emergencies. And I'm just like, I have a deep, deep fear of dentists. A lot of people do, but mine's, I think, very tied to growing up, mm-hmm. going to illegal dentists and hearing my mom like cry. And yeah. There's not that level of Novocaine. So, in those places. And so like, I think the one time I went to get my wisdom tooth pulled, like, it was so sweet. The dental assistant was like singing me songs and gave me toys to squeeze. And there was like the Office play, which I don't like The Office as a show, but like The Office was playing in the background. I just felt kind of like I was like in another place. It was okay, in other words. So I maybe just got to find a really great dental team, but I still didn't go back. I'm still scared. I'm still terrified of going to the dentist.
Yeah. My mom also actually only goes to, I don't even know if they're illegal or not, but they're like a lot cheaper. So I'm assuming there's some, you know, like activity going on. Mm-hmm. But she's only been to the dentist like 3 times in her life. And I think also because of that I don't prioritize my dental health, which honestly, I still think to this day, it's fine. Like, it's fine if our teeth are not that great if we're 70. Like, it's going to be fine, right?
I feel like I am not the person to be asking. I'm clearly biased. I'm just like nodding and being like, yeah. But I'm sure all my friends are like, no, Jay, no, 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 Karen.
No, like my partner is like very, like she, my partner grew up like really, or her, my partner's mom really, really mm-hmm. like emphasized her dental care. So now my partner's like always nagging me about it. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, no. So after talking about your mom for so long, you also write about your dad in the book, and which is like really, really closely tied with gambling culture. And you write, you do not shy away from that aspect of your upbringing. And while I was reading the book, I was thinking how, like, I feel like gambling is also, like, a sign or an attempt to hold on to some sort of hope of, like, changing things or getting a better future. Right. And there's so much, like, tenderness, but also, like, anger at the same time in the book. Like you said, you were a bitter child. So how did you see your father when you were a child?
Yeah, the book is very clearly, you know, dedicated to my mom. It's a big love song to her of sorts. But, you know, obviously my father is a big part of my family story. And I think that, you know, growing up with him was complicated because in many ways I think that my mom hid a lot of things that happened, I think, from us in terms of my father's drinking and his gambling, and you know, sometimes he would disappear for weeks in Atlantic City, or I honestly, we didn't know where he was. We just, I mean, assumed he was in Atlantic City, and he would just kind of go off and gamble. And you know, it's really interesting in terms of like thinking about estrangement in the family. The chapter To Love a Mosquito, which kind of really dives into that estrangement. And I think toxic masculinity as well, but also tenderness, as you mentioned. Really, I had to write that chapter through kind of the lens of my brother, because I think my brother sees my father in a very different way. And that chapter, It was really hard to write because obviously, there's this one scene, and well, it was real life, but having to write that scene was really difficult, of when my brother tries to reconcile, continually tries to reconcile with my father. It never quite works, like he goes over there and he tries to give our dad like NBA playoff tapes, VHS, and to watch, and my dad kind of rejects my brother, and that's, that was really hard to watch my brother come back to the car and just be enraged himself. But he has a lot of forgiveness. My brother is, I think, the sweetest person I know, and it's kind of like, how did he get this way? And what is it about him that I need to learn a little bit from my brother in terms of that, loosing some of that rage, I guess, and move it towards like what forgiveness could possibly look like. And I think that, for me and my father, I feel like I forgive him fully, and I miss him even. And it's really hard to kind of like hold that at the same time, holding the fact that I can't forgive him as a husband. I can't, my mom's rage towards him, like that's something I can't understand. As a daughter, I forgive him. As, in terms of my mother, I can't, knowing now some of the things that, he put my mother through, it's just, that's more complicated. All to say, he's a complicated person. He's a complicated character in the book. I didn't want to demonize him in the book. I mean, he's there's still even the kind of the opening chapter at the end of the title essay, like he, I still hope for reconciliation. Like I hope to see him when he's 90. It's really hard. I think that, for anyone who's ever had an estranged relationship with a family member, it's a little gut-wrenching because you're always thinking to yourself, what could have been? Like why? And to be so close, like my brother and my dad live so close to each other. It's like 20, 25 minutes, and to not have that person in your life. Oh, and so yeah, it's definitely been something that's I really wanted to speak to that in the memoir because it shaped our lives. I mean, it changed everything, to lose the restaurant, to have my parents' relationship kind of blow up like that, and they were arranged, so they were strangers. Like they didn't know anything about each other, so it's interesting that like I came out of that, so surprise, here I am. So
Oh my gosh. How did you, I guess, like in retrospect, and how did you see your mom as a child, who was going through so much abuse, trauma, and I don't know, still being so kind and gentle and poetic.
There was one thing I didn't really want to write about in the book, which I didn't, which is I offer glimpses of it, but when my mother was kind of younger and kind of in the depths of that relationship with my father, and again hiding so much abuse, I think from us, she was not necessarily the nicest person to me and my brother. She had no interest in us, and it's hinted at in the book, but like she didn't I didn't have like physical touch from her. I didn't get hugs. I wasn't told, now she always tells me like, I love you, I love you, and I'm like freaking out because I don't know what to do with it. My brother and I have a hard time saying back, I love you, even though we really deeply do. But I think we are in many ways like brought back to those early days when we couldn't possibly understand what she went through. As someone who was so young, my mom had me when she was 20. And so I think that in her mind, she just was not, she was going through so much in terms of moving to a new country. But like my father was abusive and had so many kind of addictions. So I feel like in many ways, like she was a different person then. She was like a different version of herself. And I think when she, like who she is now and who she's become, now that she's like kind of like free from all of that, not necessarily like obviously daily life is difficult too, but she is kind of a kind of like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but she has a deeper wisdom, I think, now in terms of understanding, like, you know, that her ultimate goal, I think, for us as her children is for us to be happy. And so she never asked, she always asked on the phone, you know, like, are you happy? Like, are you happy? Like, you know, it's never really kind of like about work or, you know what I mean? Like, she's just, she, even when I was going through, the, you know, the end of high school, et cetera, I was taking all these honors classes and like studying really hard. And she was just like, just take a dumber class. You're stressed. She was like, go to the lower level. It's okay. And so, but she changed a lot, I think, after my father left. I think she was just very focused on being at peace. And so she has always been, you know, the most important person in my life. It's always freaking me out how much I look like her as I inch into my last year of my 30s. It's very odd to, you know, I see very much my mom always, you know, you capture your parents in a particular moment in time and they're like stamped in your mind as that age. And I feel like my mom, for me, like my mom at like 30, in her late 30s is like my vision of her as someone who's like finally got her shit together, basically, you know? And so she's always had her shit together, but like to a degree where she finally knew herself. And so it's kind of weird moving into that space at that time, you know, after they split up. So yeah, she's great. Hilarious too. She's funny.
My mom also had me when she was 21. And I like when I got to 21, I was like, wow, I cannot imagine having a baby right now. Like, my baby would be like 3 years old right now at
I
this
would
present
have,
moment. Like, what the fuck?
I was like, I would have a 19-year-old. Think about
Oh,
that. Right? That's math. I'm 39, so
holy wow.
I would have a 19-year-old and a
You do look
16-year-old.
like so much younger, just so you know. Probably like
My
you look like
mom
10
looks
years younger, like
oh
29.
wow. It's honestly I don't know why. I mean I eat so much trash, but I mean I think I mean my mom taught me a lot about skincare. I mean she's been obsessed with skincare. I definitely wear sunscreen every day.
But yeah, I forgot what I was gonna say. and I really resonated when how you were like, you and your brother cannot say I love you to your mom.
Oh yeah.
Same here. And I'm sure with a lot of other Asian American folks. But like you said, I feel like this book is a whole like giant I love you letter. And I'm wondering, just curious, like when you were asking for her permission to be in the book, like what was her reaction to like being in your book?
I mean, minus the root canal essay, which she did take some time with. I think that she was absolutely like absolutely yes. So she was so excited. I think that she knows by now, and I guess everyone knows by now that, you know, all my books are kind of for her. Like everything I write is ultimately kind of for her, about her, obsessed with her. She's funny. She's like she's like, why are you so obsessed with me? She's just like constantly, but also she's like at the same time, like, yes, please continue. I'm amazing. She's very confident. My mom is like, I aspire to her confidence, I guess, in terms of like, you know, she can walk into a room and she is the focal point. Like there's something about her energy that is, she's a total extrovert. She's just somebody who is going to to kind of like, I don't know, like kind of almost, I mean, it sounds cheesy, but kind of change your life. I mean, she has, weirdly, when she gives advice to random strangers or your friends, it's just, it's very odd. She does have this kind of strange knack for knowing something that you might not know, which I think is a kind of, I don't know, ancestral, yeah, clairvoyance or something going on there for sure. But I think that, you know, now I'm losing track of, oh yes, that's right. We're talking about how my mom kind of received the book and everything too. And I think that she knows everything about me. And so like, it wasn't a surprise at all when she read the book. I also did the audiobook. So she was able to actually read my work. So that was pretty cool. Yeah, she was proud. I think she was excited. I think she said she laughed a lot, which made me happy. I felt like I really wanted her to laugh at quite a few parts, but I think that she, was definitely not expecting, I think, like people wanting to meet her, and that she was like, I mean, she's confident, but she didn't think she was special, you know, and she is special. And so when my mom kind of came to Seattle to read at, or be in conversation with me for my book launch, and then she also came to my Jersey leg of the tour as well. So she was kind of on tour with me, sort of, and people were asking for her signature.
That's so cute.
It was super cute. She was like, me, really? And it was so cute. She was like, of course, she was like signing books, and she was like, my parking is up. I can only sign one more. So cute. So amazing. Yeah, so it was, I think she's been really quite delighted. Now that I'm going back to the East Coast, I guess next month, and I'll be in like Maine and Connecticut and Boston and New York and New Jersey, and my mom's like basically asking if she can come on tour again, or like, and I was like, well, maybe not all of it, but some of it. So she's
celebrity.
She's into it. I don't know. I think there's something that's clicked in where she's just kind of like, oh, this is me. We get free wine. Like, you know, she's like, wow. Wow, what a life, Jane. I was like, it's not that glamorous, but she really wants to be back on tour. And she will be for the Jersey events for sure. But I'm not sure if she'll be at the others. We'll see. We'll see.
That is so cute. Oh my gosh. I want wongmom.com too.
Yeah, wongmom.com, which is a made-up character in the book, it's my mom that lives in the internet, is going to be real, so don't worry. Yeah, well, let me be more specific. We're not making her fully AI because I'm afraid. I'm kind of afraid that she's gonna go and like, I don't know what she's going to do, but my friend,
are valid.
Right? My friend, we're just going to have her. I bought the domain. So, I mean, it will exist, and it will be kind of like a nod to old GeoCity sites and AOL and kind of the early days of the internet. So I think it's going to be kind of funny, and there's going to be a lot of Easter eggs, you know, like you click on things and it will send you somewhere, or it'll be a goat screaming or something.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's in the works. It'll be definitely done you know, before the paperback comes out, but okay. I'm excited. My friend and I are making this.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay. We're heading up to the last few questions. So as a professor who teaches, what are some difficult moments that you've encountered and the rewarding moments as well?
Oh my goodness. Wow. I feel like, especially since I'm not teaching this fall, it's going to be I think the first time I haven't taught since 2008. It's going to be so weird. I'm excited to be on sabbatical. My students are excited for me. They're just like, probably sad. I mean, trying to get into my class this past last quarter, this past spring was hard. I think it was a very long wait list because they knew that it was coming. I was like, oh, they're gonna graduate. I've had a lot of challenging times teaching, and I think oftentimes those challenging times have always been, I think over the years, like how to deal with students who are just like straight up racist. And it's one of those things. Like I just remember a student of mine in a class kind of made a disparaging comment, about another student's work, and that student just happened to be, a student of color, and it was racist. And it's one of those moments as a teacher, it's kind of like, what do you do, actually, for the safety of your other students, and like, what authority do you have? Like, what do you do? And it's just like, I was just like, you need to leave my classroom. Well, you need to go. And maybe that's a different call. Maybe some people
Yes.
feel teaching moments as that whole idea is like, try to turn it into a teaching moment, and try to kind of like talk about what's happened. But in that moment, I was like, no, you need to go. Like, I
That it in
my
itself is
call.
a teaching moment.
Yeah, it's like my call. It was not just me. The thing is, a classroom is not just the professor and then like the students. Like, it's a community. So it wasn't even just me making that call. The other students were saying kind of like, hey, like you can't, that's not okay. And so it was a gathering, and it was just me at the end of the day being like, you need to go, so it was, one of those moments where these challenging moments when, you really. And it's it that these things may change. You never know. Sometimes I think with teaching, it's like you never know what's gonna happen each class. Like it's probably the most like risky, I guess, in sense of like, okay, you can teach the same thing over and over again, but like, you never know what type of students you're going to get, and the days are going to be emotionally hard, right? If a student is going through something, right, and you're gonna need to help them get the care that they need to, and to connect them with folks that are licensed to do so. Like it's a challenging job. It really is, especially during the pandemic. It was, and it is, challenging, I think, to be an educator, because in many ways too, I realized that for a lot of my students, many of whom are like, between 18 to 20, 21, 22, is that I might be the only other adult in their life other than their parents that they kind of talk to, like in terms of like older adult. And so it's like, it almost feels kind of like I hold a lot of like, they're just like, oh, like Jane will know. And I was like, I too don't know, like I can only help you with this poem. But it's, but I feel I get it, and I treasure those moments of care, and the fact that many students are willing to share their work with me. And I feel like I have too many beautiful moments to even describe. It's every day, honestly. I feel like every day I'm in the classroom, minus some challenging moments, I've built a space. I take a lot of care to build a space, especially those first 2 weeks, so that the magic can happen. But it's, I think maybe one kind of random example is that two students fell in love in my class and they're getting married.
Oh my.
So this is, I think another couple also met in my class. I think this might be the second time this has happened. But this one's more
Oh my
recent.
God, y'all, take Jane's class if you need a
Fall in love,
if you need a
follow-up.
is a secret matchmaker.
Yes, exactly. I mean, poetry,
Yeah.
can't, how can you not? That was actually a literature of migration class, in fact, now I think about it. So, but anyway, so sweet things like that happen, and there's nothing also like more wonderful than being able to blurb your students' books. I'm in that
Yes.
mode too. Now I get to see them
Oh.
publish their work, and I have, it's so special to be able to hold their books. And so many wonderful things. I mean, once I got, in the classroom that one day in Iowa, my first class ever in 2008, I kind of knew it was, that was it. Like I know some people don't like it, you know, when you have to TA, but I was obsessed from the beginning. I was like, I love this. Like, just it, I love it. I love it. And I am glad to take a break though. Yeah. I need it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jane, for coming on the show, giving us all of this in your entirety. It was amazing. And your ill haichu
You know,
stomach.
I feel revived now. I feel like I can't, the sugar is moving through my bloodstream.
Where can listeners find your book, etc.?
Yeah, thanks, Karen. I'm only on Instagram because I can't figure out other things. And I can only do one thing at a time. So I'm not on Twitter or anything. My handle on Instagram does not have anything to do with me either. So it's just at Parade of Cats. But I should say I also like dogs. You can find my memoir, which is out right now, via Tin House. Meet me tonight in Atlantic City, and it's also coming out in paperback in April 2024. And I have a couple of poetry books too, via Alice James and Action Books. And yeah, I think that is how to find me. And in many ways, I feel kind of like, do I want to be found? Like, yeah, it's like, I hide my phone places so I don't see it. So.
Regardless of your wishes, I mean, actually, though, I will respect your wishes, but I'll put everything in the show notes.
Oh my gosh, thank you. You're so sweet, Karen. I could talk to you probably for like ever.